All right, if ever there was a setup and a slow pitch that sets up the topic here that arrived in my email box in the last 5 minutes, I've never seen it in all my years on the radio. This is just perfect. So before we go to David Morata, let me just set up a nice slow pitch here. Attorney General, that's the little red rat down in Richmond, Mark Herring, secures price gouging settlement. Listen to this. He has secured a settlement with Arlington-based Jewel Wellness Pharmacy for violating the Virginia Post Disaster Anti-Price Gouging Act. They have to pay $2,500 as part of a settlement to Little Red Rat and the government down in Richmond. Here is the sin. Attorney General Herring's complaint alleges that during the period from March 20th to March 25th, that Jewel Wellness Pharmacy charged $22 for a bottle of 16-ounce bottle of rubbing alcohol, a price level that greatly exceeded the price level at which the same or similar products were offered for sale in the business's trade area during the 10-day period before the state of emergency was declared. Jewel Wellness Pharmacy alleged they purchased the bottles of rubbing alcohol for $12.75. The attorney general contended that did not justify the price levels charged by the business. David Morata, was there ever a better setup? This lunacy of the state trying to control markets, it makes me so mad I want to jump through the window here.
Yeah. Hey, welcome, Rob.
I'm glad to have you with us. I thought that was a good way to kick us off. David Morata, the president of Morata Wealth Management, and lessons from 2020 about government regulation. This is exactly the sort of regulation that we're talking about, how much you can charge for things, and what a bad idea that is, isn't it?
The anti-price gouging laws are some of the laws that make scarcity happen. It makes shortages happen. Toilet paper is sort of a perfect example. We all remember the toilet paper shortage early in the spring.
Yeah.
The toilet paper shortage was blamed on either people hoarding toilet paper or what they call kinks in the supply chain, which is just sort of this meaningless term. First of all, no one hoarded toilet paper. Maybe there were a few cases of it, but when we all started to work at home, the use of toilet paper at home jumped by 40%. So you have all these, you know, just-in-time deliveries of toilet paper, and all of a sudden, 40% more. That means 1 week, everything's bought out, and everything for next week, too. And the next week, everything is bought out, and the week after that's bought out. And that quickly snowballs because a 40% jump in toilet paper is a huge jump. And the thing to realize on this is that at-home use of toilet paper is a different product than commercial use of toilet paper. So the at-home use is a different product. It's regulated differently. It's licensed differently. It's rolled differently. Sometimes you have these really big rolls in commercial use, but even the small rolls in commercial use also just have a different licensing scheme to them. So you had commercial use toilet paper just sitting around, and they couldn't get that into at-home use because it would require extra licensing and extra regulatory efforts, and it would require them to go through this process, which is a governmental process that you have to go through. It sometimes takes months to get those kinds of approvals. So even toilet paper itself, the free markets were not able to pivot from commercial toilet paper to at-home toilet paper quickly enough to handle the demand. One of the ways that they could have solved that problem would have been price gouging.
Mm-hmm.
So if toilet paper had been expensive, then the few people who did stock up and were smart to do so, the few people who did stock up would have wondered if they should have stocked up because the price was exceptionally high. So price gouging is a way of handling shortages, and without the price gouging, you'd simply have shortages, and you should have had much more expensive toilet paper immediately because you've got this 40% jump in demand. The thing I've noticed over the past year, and I'm almost a little bit, you know, hesitant to write about it because I'm not an expert on toilet paper purchases. I'm not an expert on how shortages run. But in every single area of the pandemic, there have been governmental regulations keeping the free market from pivoting quickly. And to pivot quickly is what the free markets are good at.
So this is what's really interesting to me is that most people probably didn't know about the difference in the commercial and the residential supply chain. And if they think about it, yeah, commercial, they need bigger roles and all that. But to think that we were going to have all of this problem because of the regulations, why they couldn't just take those boxes, take them over the stores, slap a price tag on them, and just let people buy them, because right. The government has put so many blockades and obstructions in the way. This is benefiting nobody, and yet no one really realized it was going on until we had a problem.
Right. And the free market is very good, given long periods of time, at adapting to needs. So the free market is exceptionally good at that. So over the months that subsequently happened, the supply chain got itself, you know, either licensed or regulated. They were able to slap labels on things. They were able to get the labels approved. And over the months, we've adjusted to our increased use of at-home toilet paper. And so now everything's okay and everything's working well, and we're all sort of happy about it. But we have these licensing issues and these regulatory issues that are making it difficult for the free market to be able to do what it does best, and that is to deal with issues like this quickly.
We've got just a couple minutes before we go to the break, and so I want to go to one here that I was totally unaware of because I just don't use a lot of pasta. But I was reading through your analysis here, David Murata, and I could hardly believe what I was reading, how stupid this was. So why don't you tell us what happened with pasta?
Yes, so with everyone eating at home, dinners that are easy to make are sold better, and pasta is easy to make. So pasta immediately jumped by about 40%. Mm-hmm. So again, pasta is one of those strange things that the at-home use is different than the institutional use. There's articles on there that talk about how the at-home use is going to 90 miles an hour, and the supply to restaurants has gone to zero. And so you have to figure out what you're going to do, you know, to be able to meet that demand. And at the very moment at which they're talking about meeting that demand, this one pasta brand is banned because it's got 10.9 milligrams of iron, and it's supposed to have 13 milligrams of iron per pound. And this is one of those things that probably some big pasta company turned in one of their competitors from Italy, and they tested it, and sure enough, it was missing 2.1 milligrams of iron. And that's okay for European use, but that's not apparently okay for American use. In fact, in America, we have defined what they call enriched macaroni. That's the rule that it's under. So when you buy a box of pasta, if you notice on the bottom, it will say an enriched macaroni product. And they were banned by the FDA because they were advertising their product as enriched macaroni, and that is a definition that the FDA gets to decide what the formula is for that. And they were 2.1 milligrams shy of iron, so they were banned from having any imports. So that's one of the reasons why this one brand of pasta still is not available anywhere in the United States. You can still buy it from Canada, however. First, you have the definition of pasta, and then you have the fact that the at-home use, with all of its labeling, is regulated, and all of that caused a pasta shortage this spring.
You know, I think if we surveyed people waiting in line in the grocery store who were trying to buy this pasta and there was none in there and asked any of them if they cared about the iron content being off by so little, I would imagine it was 99.99999% of the people would say, I don't care. I just want the product. I just need to buy some pasta. Don't you?
It's true. And, you know, I've noticed that there have been interesting shortages in the grocery store. I haven't gotten to the end of all of them, but lima beans were off for many weeks, and then they were back on, and then they were off again for many weeks. Everyone, when they went home, started to take up baking and yeast. There was a yeast shortage, partly because, you know, at-home yeast is different than institutional yeast, and yeast is not something you can just manufacture. You actually have to grow the yeast. There's another shortage that we experienced, all because we're being forced to stay home and the at-home product is different than the commercial product.
One of the very, very few things that I dislike with a passion is lima beans, so I'm not at all disappointed there, but I do understand the point you're making. We're talking with David Murata. He's online at muratahonmoney.com. If you have comments or questions or challenges even about price gouging and all of that, the free market, how it works here, 977-1070 is the phone number. Let's head into the break in our final segment ahead with David Murata. All right, David Morata is with us, President Morata Wealth Management, talking about lessons from 2020 about government regulation. I think the key here is we're learning a lot about things that went wrong, but how are we going to apply this? But I want to get to a couple more case studies here. Let's go very specifically to COVID testing and some of the problems that we have surrounding the regulation of that. A lot of people might say, well, that should be very highly regulated. How would you respond, David?
When it comes to COVID testing, we're sort of at the mercy of healthcare providers, and this is by government design. The CDC let out on their website, to help mitigate the impact of false results, all COVID-19 tests authorized to date are prescription only so that clinicians can interpret the results for patients. Mm-hmm. So first they made it so that you couldn't do a home COVID test, which kind of makes sense, but kind of doesn't make sense. Well, you can do a home pregnancy test. Why can't you do a home COVID test?
Mm-hmm.
And then we began to get, I don't know about you, but I've heard of a number of false negatives and false positives. You know,
yes.
Someone is tested and they don't have COVID, and they're tested again and they don't have COVID, and then the next week they come down with COVID. It was one incident of exposure, and then they isolated themselves, so we know that they didn't get it from anyone else, and they just didn't get the COVID test accurate, or if they weren't, you know, shedding the virus or something like that. And we're told that no test is 100% accurate, and we accept that explanation for why so many tests are wrong. It may be a lot higher than 70%, though, the accuracy. It may be a lot lower than that, actually. It may be all the way down at 40% accuracy, mm-hmm. which is kind of a flip of a coin. You know, do you have COVID? Just flip a coin three times, and if they all come up false, you might still have COVID. Bill Gates, someone who's not a crackpot, if you think I'm a crackpot, Bill Gates said, the majority of all U.S. COVID tests are completely garbage, wasted.
Mm.
If you don't care how late the data is, you're going to reimburse at the same level. Of course, they're going to take every customer because you're making ridiculous money. It's mostly rich people that are getting access to that. You have to have the reimbursement system pay a little bit extra for 24-hour turnaround time or 48 hours turnaround time or pay nothing if it isn't done by them. So his problem was, they're doing the COVID test, and then they're sending it out, and then they're letting it sit, or they're doing something with it, and that doesn't give a very good COVID test. So he said you need to pay a little bit more and get that COVID test back quickly, and then you get a more accurate COVID test. And now, just recently, there have been a number of articles on, you know, these COVID kiosk tests where they send it out and they go back, and that test accuracy is maybe as much as 41%. At any rate, the federal government did two things with the regulations that I think maybe they shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
One, maybe they should have allowed a home COVID test. If you trust us to get it right, why wouldn't you trust us to get it right? Sure, some people are going to get it wrong, but just because some people are going to get that process wrong doesn't mean all of us are going to get it wrong. We're going to be very careful about it. We're going to be able to test ourselves for COVID. And then second, they mandated a one reimbursement no matter how long the test takes. And again, that's not a very good method of getting it back. For both of those, it would have been better to have different testing methodologies, or you would have put a lot of testing methodologies out there and then found out which ones are accurate. As it is, I don't think a COVID test is very accurate, so I don't even know if it's worth taking one, you know, to see if I've had it or to see if I have it now. I just isolate myself and I presume I have it, which maybe is safer, but maybe it's not. So these COVID tests are another aspect to the whole thing, which, because of the regulations, are only done one way, and the one way isn't very accurate.
David, we got just a couple minutes left, so I want to go to two things. The first thing is, where do we find freedom? How do we get out of all of this? Because you mentioned lessons learned. However, did we really learn them? Is anybody going to do anything about it? Are we just going to forget about it and then just go on the way we were until it happens again?
Yes. So I'm afraid we're just going to forget about it.
Yeah.
And the answer to that is that when you say there should be a regulation or there should be a law or something like that, you just really need to stop and say, does there really need to be a law? Is that really the best way of handling it? Mm-hmm. And can't we allow people to a little bit of freedom to do things in a little bit different way? Regulations do not protect you. Even the regulations in some of the most dangerous industries we have, like meat safety or meat regulations or something like that. They have to have someone on the floor at least during each shift of meat packing regulations. That doesn't stop anything bad from happening. I'm not sure what good we're doing there, because the regulations are someone has to be there, So someone clocks in at the beginning of the shift and then clocks out, meaning that they're not there most of the time, they don't know what's happening, and they're not doing a lot of good. So even the regulations that we have are just not very good in terms of putting into place what we need to have in place. And second, price gouging is the way to handle shortages. So when we do have shortages, for the federal government or the state government to come in and say, you've price gouged, and therefore we're going to take away, you know, we're going to fine you and take away all your profits, is just not a good idea. People are willing to pay more during an emergency, and I think that's the easiest way to make sure that manufacturing ramps up, because then there's a good profit to be made, and it happens quickly, and the prices will adjust. So even just the idea of not having price gouging laws, in fact, having price gouging laws in place, meaning requiring companies to have price gouging laws, is certainly better than I'm going to buy this product and I'm going to walk around the block and I'm going to buy it again a second time. That's not a deterrent. A one per customer is not a deterrent. That kind of stuff doesn't help. And people find ways around that kind of a system. But a price is something that they can't get around, and therefore is a much better effective tool of rationing.
And it's interesting, you know, even the terminology price gouging, it implies something bad. So I think for the next time, you and I will put on our thinking caps and we'll think of another term, maybe just market pricing, you know, because that's really what's reflected here. And gouging sounds like you're doing something horrible to somebody.
Or an incentive price.
There we go.
Because what you're trying to find is a price that will give an incentive to the free markets to produce more of this thing.
That's perfect. David Morata, I knew you'd come up with it. Thank you so much. He's online at moradaonmoney.com. I always look forward to the conversations, and they're a great benefit to our community. Thanks so much, David.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll talk to you again very soon, and that's going to wrap up today's edition of The Shilling Show.